About a week or so ago, a young friend and United Church colleague who ministers in Ontario asked on a Facebook group that is frequented by some of us old codgers how we handle presiding at a public memorial service. A young member of her community had passed away, and his family had chosen to have a small family service, but afterwards to hold what's often referred to these days as a celebration of life in a larger non-church venue. There'd be a lot of people at that second gathering, and she realized that the rules of engagement were going to be just a bit different in the more public space. Being that she'd not presided at such a thing before, did any of us have any wisdom that we would like to pass on? Well, she got lots and lots of responses from the group, and there was a substantial amount of agreement as to how to proceed and how not to proceed. For example, the obvious. The celebration of life is filled with opportunity to reach people who are struggling with important spiritual questions, often for the very first time. But remember that you're not in a church, and so to be sensitive to the kind of language that we use, because the language we use in church is often completely foreign to those who might be attending the celebration of life. Nonetheless, while she would be functioning largely as an MC at that service, don't miss the opportunity in some way to bring Jesus and allow him to lead her in her work. Have some agreement ahead of the day, who's the spokesperson for the family. That's really important. And they choose who's speaking, and they get to decide the order of the gathering. Avoid, if at all possible, the dreaded open mic. They often don't end as well as hoped. People mean well, but off-the-cuff speaking can go horribly, horribly wrong. I still have cold chills from the funeral I attended, where one of the open mic speakers lightheartedly spoke about the deceased's dodgy driving habits, having seemingly forgotten that the deceased died in a traffic accident. Have an agreed-upon time limit. Keep the slideshow under 6 minutes, if you can, because it seems that that's the top end of people's attention, no matter how much loved this person is. And there was lots more. My friend later reported back that things had gone really, really well, and that she sensed that family and friends knew some comfort, and yes, she did get to mention Jesus to some 900 people. Wow. Now, it's safe to say that funerals and memorial services are always complicated in some way, because every one of them requires some level of customization, right? We're all a bit different. But having presided at both public gatherings and the ones we celebrate here in the church, I admit that I have a preference for services in the church. And that's not just because I'm familiar with the surroundings. A Christian service in a home or at graveside has a distinctly different feel to me than one that isn't within our tradition. And so here's my not so rhetorical question to start. Have you noticed a difference, a distinction between the Christian funeral and the increasingly popular secular celebration of life? I want you to hold that question for a bit. For me, there is a massive difference. When I first looked at the scripture reading that Melody shared with us, particularly the gospel reading, I had a bit of a sense of deja vu. I mean, didn't I just preach on that same gospel passage a couple of weeks ago? And in a way I did, I suppose. There's some real close similarities between the Mark 13 passage, which was our gospel reading the week before last, and the one we heard this morning from Luke. Mark's 13th chapter and Luke's 21st chapter are in many ways parallel accounts. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if Luke had seen Mark's version. Or perhaps he might have had the same person tell him the story that was told to Mark. Though it should be noted that Luke ends his account a bit differently. I can imagine someone saying, "Oh, Luke, you've got to record this one. It was a powerful day, but it was also kind of disturbing. We were finally in Jerusalem. We were just leaving the temple. Jesus had drawn our attention to this poor widow there. And then the story was told and retold. There are some distinctions. There are lots of similarities in the two passages. Luke writes about persecution and witnessing, about the destruction of Jerusalem, and how the Son of Man will come on the cloud of power and on a cloud with power and glory, accompanied by many signs in the heavens. Luke records Jesus saying, as Mark does, though in slightly different terms, but both do this in this dreamy, symbolic, cosmic kind of language, that there are going to be terrible times. And so the faithful need to stay alert and to not be fearful, and to not be overwhelmed, but indeed to raise their heads, to actually be encouraged. And why? Because what seems like judgment and cataclysm are actually signs that our redemption is drawing near. So yes, this is another example of apocalyptic literature. Apocalypse meaning a revealing of something that was previously hidden from view. It has to do with the conclusion of things, that we're not on this never-ending road of progress, perpetually evolving into something better, but rather this existence we're experiencing actually has a goal, a telos, an end. That it's not all random, but there's a destination to which God is leading all of us. So pay attention. Be alert to the signs of the times. Now, the church is an odd organization in some ways, and arguably in a lot of ways. We are both in the world and not of the world, to use that expression that Jesus uses. We find it in John chapter 17. In the world, but not of the world. But while we have some significant differences from our surrounding culture, Jesus also sends us into the world, because that's where our mission lies. And so there are some ways that we are very much a part of the way the world does things. For example, today is the day we set the budget for the coming year. And we try to do that in an open and transparent way. We use accepted accounting practices and function in some ways like a business. But in other ways, we're not like a business at all. And so to try and make it so can actually end up subverting the mission that God's given us. And so we make some of our decisions anyway in different ways than other organizations might. Another way things are different here is that, well, it's the way we keep time. We keep time in the church in a way that is distinct from the rest of the world. For example, Sunday is not the last day of the weekend. It's not the end of the week for us. It's actually the first day of the week. And today isn't simply the first Sunday in December to the church. It's the season of Advent. It's the first of the four Sundays before December 25th, our celebration of Christmas. And it serves as a kind of our New Year's Day. And I just want to comment on all the Christmas decoration that's been brought to us today. That's lovely. It helps set the mood, I think. So we're in the midst of observing an annual cycle. We are again on the first Sunday of Advent, which starts in the same thematic place every year on the liturgical calendar. Speaking of liturgical calendars, One enterprising congregation in Vancouver some years ago decided to start producing calendars that are based on the church calendar. And they look rather different than the ones we normally get. And they're laid out differently. So, for example, Advent, we have 4 weeks. That works. That looks like a familiar calendar. But then the next season is Christmas, and there's only 2 weeks on this calendar. It's really interesting, and so I'm going to invite you to have a look at it after the service, okay? It's kind of neat. Anyway, if you look at the gospel readings for each year, on the first Sunday of Advent, you'll see that it's always some kind of cosmic apocalyptic literature. They're always on the theme of staying alert and tough times are coming and things are going to get nasty. That's always how the church begins Advent. To which I say, what's up with that? I mean, pay attention. The world's ending doesn't exactly move us fluidly into Christmas cheer, does it? Doesn't quite get us into silent night, snow that's deep and crisp and even, or take us to roasting chestnuts on an open fire. No, there's precisely nothing sentimental about the church in Advent. Nothing. Not that we're opposed to enjoying the season, far from it. I love Advent. Sky, you were saying the other night, it's your favorite season. I'm with you. I rather hope that we are always known as those who, and I quote, know how to keep Christmas well, if anyone alive possessed the knowledge, to borrow Dickens' description of Scrooge from the conclusion of that wonderful story, A Christmas Carol. This season is all the more wonderful for us because while we celebrate with the best of them, we're also hopelessly realistic, or perhaps I should say that differently. We are hopefully realistic. Advent is the time when we prepare for the coming of Jesus. As I tried to say last week, in some ways we play act in the church. We try to enter into and participate in the story of Christ's life through our observance of the yearly cycle of seasons and events. And in Advent, we prepare for Jesus coming at Christmas as if he's coming for the first time. We try to get our internal house in order for his arrival as one of us. It's traditionally been a penitential time, just the same way as Lent is. And so we try to get our lives in order for Jesus' arrival as one of us, as a human being who was born as we were born, who had family and friends, and who grew and experienced life in most of the ways that we still do. We marvel that God would choose to come and live amongst us as one of us with all the limitations and the challenges that we have. But we also begin this season of preparation clear-headed at least about two things. First of all, the world we live in is really, really hard. To live in our world is to experience constant challenge and disruption. And some of that's external, and some of that's internal. Some of it's thrust at us from the world around us. And so we have violence and not so good marriages and want and betrayal and distress amongst nations, which is the opening line of our gospel this morning. And that's the external. Some of it's internal. It just bubbles up within us. It's here in our hearts. And we look inside, and if we're actually being honest, some of it's not so pretty. Yeah, there's much joy in living. There's much to be celebrated. There are times of peace. But we disciples are painfully aware that things are not okay. We need help. And we wonder if our redemption is ever going to draw near. If you occasionally get the sense that things are falling apart, well, I dare say you're just paying attention. Because as I was saying 2 weeks ago in that sermon on Mark's passage, worlds are falling apart. Worlds are falling apart. Personal worlds and larger cultural worlds. Christians know we can't do this on our own. We need some help. Which brings me to the second thing I think we're aware of. We're also preparing for an end. We're preparing for the end. I asked at the beginning of the sermon what you sense might be the difference between a Christian funeral and the secular celebration of life. Because both mark the end of a life, but the hallmark of the Christian service has always been this: hope. From the very, very first, Christians have seen death much differently. And we have from the very first. Remember how the Apostle Paul, he said, wrote this to the Thessalonian church. But we do not want you to be uninformed, brothers and sisters, about those who have died, so that you may not grieve as others who do not have hope. We don't live or die desperately, for we have hope. And we also hear that hope in our first reading this morning from Jeremiah. Jeremiah proclaimed in a time in Israel's life when they were about to crash and burn in the most spectacular way as a nation. The country was about to be overrun, and many, if not most, of the people were about to enter into slavery and exile in Babylon. He told them this was what was going to happen if they didn't change their ways, and no, they didn't. But amidst all of that, he offered hope. That out of the death of the nation there would be life, that they had reason to hope, and that help was on its way. In a time when there is so much death around us, you would be forgiven for thinking that death wins. And so when we Christians gather to say farewell to a friend, we say our goodbyes with hope, with the assurance that all isn't as it seems. That's why we lit the first candle today, the candle of hope, in our Advent wreath. For this morning, we celebrate that help is on its way. So friends, it's Advent. Raise your heads. Amen.